to Grow a Human, My Frankenstein Summer with Dr. Philip Ball, Episode 6, Living with Our Creation.
I really enjoyed the cafes in Boston.
Right, Abigail, here's your tall summer outside, for sure.
Thank you.
A city once renowned for its trade in tea.
Peppermint dirty chai, 1%.
These days, Boston is better known for its coffee. But you have to wonder how much longer it'll be before those baristas are all replaced by an interactive terminal that takes your order and makes it just how you want it.
Hello, Dr. Ball. Can I interest you in a cappuccino today?
In post-coronavirus times, might it be necessary to automate even more tasks like this to reduce human contacts? The robotic barista could be pretty simple for today's AI, but these technologies are already finding roles in far more complicated tasks, like the healthcare diagnoses being trialled by IBM's Watson Health at the labs I visited in the last episode. Of course, sometimes what we want from doctors and nurses is the human interaction.
Have a good day.
That, after all, is why a good barista can still add to the atmosphere of a cafe. But the COVID-19 pandemic has forced us to face the possibility that human interaction might in the future be precisely what we'll need to avoid. Can AI ever be a real substitute for that? That's the issue I'm going to investigate in this final episode, the interactions between people and machines and how society might change as these become increasingly a part of our lives. For many people, the kinds of fears raised by Mary Shelley's Frankenstein of technology run amok are today invoked by developments like AI, which in the popular imagination become very much like the creature that will turn on its creator.
But it's true, I am a wretch. I have murdered the lovely and helpless. I have devoted my creator to that irredeemable ruin. There he lies, white and cold in death. I look on the hands which executed the deed. I think on the heart in which the imagination of it was conceived, and long for a moment when these hands will meet my eyes, when that imagination will haunt my thoughts no more.
But is that how it'll really be? Or will we forge a more amenable, more productive relationship? I knew just the person to ask about that. His name is Iyad Rawan, and until recently he was working at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT. Iyad is very much a rising star. He's Syrian by birth, and I first came across him in 2012 when he was working in Abu Dhabi at the Masdar Institute of Science and Technology. At MIT, he's been looking at the intersection between the computer sciences and the social sciences, in particular at the interface of humans and machines, issues such as collective intelligence, how people exchange information via machines, how they interact with machines, and the general social aspects of artificial intelligence.
Okay, well, maybe it's easiest to talk about the kind of how I got here first quickly. And I did my PhD in AI, but not the cool type. You know, the cool type turned out to be machine learning and deep learning. I did the other type, which is symbolic reasoning and that sort of thing in multi-agent systems. And then sort of slowly drifted away from being interested in AI and more interested in people. So I was interested in studying social media and how it facilitates new forms of cooperation or mobilization. And this is how I got really interested in things like the use of Twitter or social media to mobilize millions of people to search for things or to search for individuals in remote cities. And you covered kindly one of our stories.
In 2011-12, Iyad took part in a competition set by the US State Department called the Tag Challenge, which aimed to use social media to locate people in remote cities using only their mugshots, pictures of them released to the public.
That's right. So the Tag Challenge was we were meant to find people using their mugshots in remote cities. Can you use social media to do this? And I remember, and we won this this challenge from Dubai, where we were using these incentive structures to incentivize people to look for the information, but also to recruit their friends to the cause. And we wrote a paper, and it was sort of still, you know, in we're about to submit it, and then there was the Boston Marathon bombing here.
IAD's team won the tag challenge, but as it was unfolding, the bombing at the Boston Marathon took place, and a challenge like this became very real as people tried to identify, just from TV and camera footage, the perpetrators of that crime.
And people started using social media to search for the perpetrators. Mm-hmm. This is in the 2 days when they were on the run. Actually, they ended up being on the campus, and they actually killed one of the MIT police. We released the paper at the time because we thought, you know, it can be done. You know, you can find people through the crowd, but they're, in this case, they're specifically hiding. So I was interested in these sort of processes, like what makes social networks able to, like online social networks specifically, able to mobilize. And to do this, you need to, it's not really a computer science problem as much of a social science problem or a network science problem or a problem of understanding incentives that mobilize people or why people do these things, how fast do they respond to each other's messages. So this is all behavioral. So I became sort of interested in the collective behavior online.
With this background in socially mediated information technologies, IAD found himself wondering how our own behaviours are likely to be affected when we hand over some of the decision-making to machines and AI, and how we will interact with them as they become increasingly like entities that think.
I felt like, well, I have a background in AI, and I've been studying humans on social media, and now these things are going to merge. Mm-hmm. So cars are going to drive themselves on the road where people are driving and people are crossing the street. There will be bots online sharing information, filtering information, manipulating information potentially together with people. So again, there's more and more sort of systems where a combination of human behavior and AI behavior is going to interact. And I became fascinated by the sorts of questions that you can ask, because that's a new kind of tool, and we've never seen this before. And I felt like, well, science also has perspective on these things. Will people cooperate with machines if they know their machines? What do people expect from machines? Do they expect the same thing from an AI car as they expect from a human? So we need to, I think, understand the human psyche and how it interacts with these entities to be able to thrive with them in the future.
Very recently, IAD became involved in a project looking into the ethics of self-driving vehicles and the question of how we're going to program them to determine what they will do in the case of an emergency, a situation that might cause an accident. I asked him how he ended up pondering issues like this.
You know, I had a philosopher on a panel with me once say, we already figured all of these problems out since Thomas Aquinas, right? Thomas Aquinas gave you the answer. Done.
Thomas Aquinas? Well, that wasn't entirely what I expected. But this 13th century Italian priest was an astute moral philosopher who laid down a number of ethical rules for judging morality in complex situations. Even today, moral philosophers still pay heed to what he said. Moral philosophy crops up when you think about how to program driverless cars to deal with collisions, because it's related to a famous thought experiment called the trolley problem. The scenario is that there's a runaway trolley car on a track headed towards a group of people who will be killed by the collision. But you're standing by a lever that could divert the trolley onto another track where it would only hit one person. The question is, do you pull the lever? Do you let the accident happen to several people or intentionally kill one? This used to be just an abstract philosophical problem, but driverless vehicles make it a very real dilemma.
And, of course, that leaves out the question of how you would implement Thomas Aquinas in the car. But, you know, as in terms of ethical principle, it's been figured out. But that's a normative principle that comes from a particular culture, right? And guess what? Not everybody subscribes to that culture, right? There are many other cultures in the world. The machine has new capabilities that necessitate new answers. So, for example, a human may not know the outcome with such precision, in which case anything sort of is defensible, right? But maybe a machine can figure out outcomes with more certainty. So if that is the case, can we still apply the same rule, or is a new rule necessary? If you're applying a rule in one situation, but then 10 million cars get the same rule instantly, what sort of outcome does that create? That's different from human society, where rules are sort of applied and implemented to a different degree by different people, because you have different people with different ethical standards or motivations and so on.
And it sounds like there's nothing kind of preordained about that. I mean, maybe the temptation, I think you said, was to imagine that we have moral frameworks and we just have to fit the machines into those. Whereas, mm-hmm. in fact, it seems clear that the new possibilities of social media and machines generally bring up new questions that we haven't considered before, or alter our behavior in ways that we haven't considered before. Right. So it's not as though we already have moral answers and we know how, we just need to know how to implement them.
I think it's a combination of an analytical exercise, but also maybe a psychological exercise to see if people would trust a car programmed according to that standard. Because they may say, no, I'm okay with my doctor doing, you know, either sacrificing the mother or the child in a complicated birth, right? These are, I think, some of the cases that Thomas Aquinas looked at.
Right.
But I'm not comfortable with a machine doing that, right? Making that call. Maybe I need a human being to be involved, and so on, right? So I think we still don't know. You know, there's so many questions.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess that also comes down to the kind of reasoning that we can expect machines to have. Because confronted with a situation like that, I mean, certainly with a doctor confronted with a situation like that, it's not as though he or she looks up in a table, you know, what to do, and the answer is there. There's a balancing of so many things, some of them not even articulated, but that are just normative in our society. Mm-hmm. And we kind of accept that's, you know, a doctor will do the best that they can under those situations. Yes. Whereas if you're deciding, if you're actually going to program into a machine, mm-hmm. an algorithm to make that decision, it's it's not obvious that it's the same process, is it, I guess?
Correct. And I think also finding the right metaphors, or finding what is this problem that we're facing with the machine now? Which older problem does it map to? It's sometimes kind of surprisingly difficult to anticipate ahead of time. And I think this is where science also helps. So to give you an example, around 2013, 2014, all of these articles about how you should program a car, you know, to behave in an imminent accident where there's unavoidable harm. Lots of normative opinions about that. So we started by saying, well, let's ask people and see what they think. And maybe we can just provide a public opinion as a lens, you know, or as an additional input to this process, to this discussion. But then we asked people, we just thought, we might ask people two questions. Let's ask them, what do they think the car should do? But also, which car would they buy? And we instantly, you know, found this, in hindsight, obvious conclusion, which is, they want a car that minimizes harm, but they will never buy it. They want the car that only protects them.
Keep them safe.
So I think, so this is a very simple experiment, right? Mm. But it taught us that AI ethics, at least in this case, is not a question of normative, finding the normative rule. It's a question of cooperation. It's enforcing the outcome that people think is normatively correct. And then we did the subsequent study, which asks people to decide what the car should do in an imminent accident. And then we had 40 million decisions from people worldwide, which allowed us to then not only find out that there's a disconnect between consumer preferences and citizen preferences, but also that there are cross-cultural differences in those preferences. And again, I think that's another dimension that we, people who are interested in regulating AIs and building AIs, need to take into account. So this is how I see my role, as using science to bring in new things that should be taken into account. to inform this discussion?
You know, there are self-driving cars, but they're a long way, I mean, further, I think, than people often realize from being something that you can go out and buy. But it feels almost as though this is still a kind of an experimental test case for the kind of, for much more general reasoning. I mean, it almost sounds like, you know, what you say about people's responses to what they would choose, you know, as opposed to what they think is kind of right generally. Yeah. It's kind of like an analogy, a metaphor for society generally. That people tend to say, yes, I want public services. Yes, I want good spending on libraries and schools, but I don't want to pay lots of taxes. So we've lived with this kind of dilemma for a long time. But it's interesting that now it's, you know, technologies are really forcing us to confront it.
But then, you know, how we, I guess how we deal with it is also brings up new challenges, I suppose, because in the old days, you know, we dealt with those, the way we dealt with those dilemmas has had to do a lot with our understanding of human nature. But now with machines making decisions, you know, whether it's, you know, decisions about policing or decisions related to selling products or price differentiation, all sorts of things. It's machines that are now learning those new behaviors. And I guess we don't necessarily have a mental model of the machine the way that we did with the humans. Because humans are kind of like us. We've been living with them for a long time. You know, we've been living with each other for millennia, and we've evolved a set of norms and expectations, but machines don't have those constraints. So given a certain, and I'm not talking about paperclip, you know, colonizing the universe to make paperclip scenarios. You know, it's a much more benign version of that scenario. Is you simply ask the machine to sell more insurance policies or sell more IVF services, right? And then machines could learn all kinds of sophisticated, unexpected, potentially seriously unethical strategies to achieve those goals. Like, let's encourage people to delay, you know, who do want to have kids, to delay wanting to have children, because maybe they'll need IVF in the future. So how can we, maybe we should push more advertisements of holiday opportunities, you know, give them deals on holidays. It's not far-fetched for an algorithm, a reinforcement learning algorithm, tasked with that goal to learn the strategy. I mean, it has to be a very villainous human to think of something like this. But a machine could learn this, and people who run these companies don't even need to know. They wouldn't even know, because the machines are learning their own representations of causal relationships in the world and exploiting those representations. So unless we build a science of the behavior of the machine, then we're not going to be able to keep these things under control. And thrive with them, right? Which is what we want.
And at the moment, machines that do this kind of thing, if they're based on machine learning, then what they're doing is really just looking for correlations. That's all. That, oh, if this happens, it tends to make this happen.
That's right.
And they're exploiting that. So,
yes.
So you know, obviously there's no moral reasoning in there, but it's also that they might spot unexpected correlations that we don't even think of looking for. I mean, I guess that was what came out of the AlphaGo algorithm that, you know, defeated the best human Go player, and it came up with strategies that no one had ever thought of.
Let me explain this a little more. Google DeepMind, an AI project run by Alphabet Incorporated, has developed a program called AlphaGo, which was able to play the game of Go, a Chinese game that's one of the oldest and most complex on the planet. In 2015, the algorithm beat the renowned Korean professional player Lee Sedol. AlphaGo is what's called a deep learning algorithm. As we heard in the previous episode, this looks at connections, correlations between some set of input data and outcomes based on that data to find effective strategies for achieving desired outcomes. It learns strategies using a set of training data where you already know the outcome, and then it's ready to go in situations where the outcome is still open. It's simple-minded in principle, but astonishingly effective in practice, at least for some types of problem.
We have good reason to think that machines just built on this really quite simple-minded approach, isn't it, of just looking for correlations, that they will find things, routes, strategies that no one, that we wouldn't imagine. So we certainly couldn't anticipate building into the machine some way of preventing them from acting in these ways we think were unethical.
Exactly, yeah. Because we can't anticipate. Yes, yeah. So I think AlphaGo is a perfect example because, you know, you give the machine one objective and a very powerful technology for achieving that objective, which is, you know, deep reinforcement learning. And the objective is to win the game. And then it discovered this completely foreign, alien way of achieving the goal. And it took, you know, experts in Go a while, you know, and I think they're still digging into those games to try and understand how this machine is thinking and how, you know, what is it about those strategies that's so effective, right? Mm-hmm. And so you could imagine, and this is in the closed world, closed full information world of Go. So imagine if you have a similar machine learning to do something else, like sell things, you know, and this machine works for a conglomerate that sells a whole bunch of products. You know, what could this machine figure out in terms of, and it's reinforcement learning, it's actually exploiting causal relationships, not just correlation, right? Mm-hmm. What could it learn about what sort of things you get children into when they're young so that when they get older, they become your customer? I mean, that is not an impossible thing for an algorithm to learn. Mm-hmm. If it's learnable and if you have the data, they will learn it before we discover it. So they're going to discover new ways of sort of capitalist strategization and maybe consumer exploitation potentially. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's great when it's empowering us and it's personalizing products for us. That's perfect and it helps us live better lives. But it can also have the opposite effect and we wouldn't know. So I think the only other strategy that we can do is the strategy that has been effective so far with another sophisticated intelligence, namely human intelligence. We live in this world reasonably peacefully with other humans, despite not understanding their machinery. And it's because we have good models of them, of their reasoning and behavior. And thanks to behavioral science and improving, you know, over the last few decades, we have increasingly a better understanding of this human behavior, individual and collective behavior. So I've I've invited a collection of computer scientists as well as behavioral scientists, like from political science and economics and anthropology and biology. And we recently wrote a kind of manifesto that just got published in Nature a couple of months ago titled Machine Behavior. And it's basically a call to arms that to be able to live in the world with these increasingly sophisticated AIs, we need a behavioral science of machines as much as an engineering science of machines. So is a machine being racist? Is it discriminating when it sorts CVs? Is it discriminating when it recommends who should go on parole or who shouldn't? Or when it allocates bed space in a hospital and so on and so forth. These are all behavioral questions, and presumably behavioral scientists have a lot to say about those questions. They're the experts in these things.
This is a radical but timely idea, to build a science of machine behavior, which we would pursue just as we do in studying human or animal behavior. It accepts that even though we're the architects of the machines, we don't know for sure what they'll do, and we'll just have to find out. I was just in time to speak to Ayad about these things in Boston because he was literally on the eve of departing for Berlin, where he is going to set up a new centre for studying machine behaviour.
It's interesting that you, the way you talk about the machines and understanding the way they think. I mean, we don't even have a language to do it that isn't anthropomorphizing the machine. Yes. And, you know, we say the machine is being racist. And say, of course, the machine is it's completely insensate. Exactly. In a way that we recognize as racist. And I mean, is that a, you know, there seems already to be this sort of perception
perhaps at the sort of popular level, that if we make AI sophisticated enough, either it's going to at some stage become like us, or it's going to become like the robot overlord that will take us over. For some reason, it will be malicious. But actually, the way it's working at the moment with machine learning doesn't obviously, it's not obviously like the way we think.
I think you're absolutely right. That, and maybe the AlphaGo example is instructive in that, you know, it didn't win using a conventional strategy. So if we were only looking for conventional strategies, we wouldn't understand. So I think we need to be open. And this is, I think, why we need a broader scientific approach to it, because if we just take a layperson approach, we're going to excessively anthropomorphize the machine and maybe miss what it's actually doing. But if we have a systematic way of studying its behavior that is grounded in the scientific method, in behavioral, good behavioral science practices, then hopefully we will come up with, you know, as this Cambrian explosion of AI is taking place, we will develop classification methodologies for, you know, all of the AI species and the different kinds of AI intelligences that are emerging and the kinds of pathologies that they could develop, if you like. And I think that's a precondition for having everything under control, right? Like a very small example that we worked on, we published last year, is this idea of cooperating with machines. So there's a lot of work on how humans cooperate, even though they have a temptation to be selfish. What we did is we picked an AI reinforcement learning program, and we paired it with people for the first time, and we started studying the dynamics of this interaction. And, you know, one of the interesting things we found is there was this particular algorithm that can signal, you know, so it can do things like threats and promises and suggestions, and it can cooperate with people. But then when you look at the behavioral level of how it actually achieved that. So it was able to achieve cooperation on par with human-human cooperation. But it was doing it using different strategies. So for example, it was less positive, it was more threatening.
Wow.
You know, so that's one example. And I think it's a very early example, right? So, but an interesting follow-up question would be, suppose that I have to interact with humans as well as algorithms. If machines are more vindictive, let's say, then I may have to develop new ways of reacting, you know, new norms as a myself as a human. Would this then impact the way I interact with other humans? You know, is there some kind of behavioral contagion between our interaction with machines and interaction with other humans? We have no clue, right?
Presumably, we're already seeing an aspect of that when we're interacting with one another through machines.
Yes.
It does seem that behavior changes, you know, online trolling and all the rest of it, and, you know, the anonymity of that.
Yes.
It's already concerning, I guess.
And I think some people have also been saying that children who interact with chatbots like Alexa start using more imperative, you know, language rather than asking other people, you know, with other children.
Yeah.
You know, so they start ordering other children rather than asking them politely. So, you know, I still think we're within an early stage in the science, but I think we really need to figure it out.
So there's a lot for IAD to explore in Berlin. It seems the challenge here in anticipating the interactions of human and machine is partly that the machines and algorithms we use at the moment create no guarantee of moral probity. We can't assume that they will observe the moral rules we recognise and try to cultivate in society. They're not immoral, but amoral. Now, you might hope that we could simply enforce morality by programming it in at the outset. But remember Isaac Asimov's seminal 1950 book, I, Robot? It showed how attempts to do something like that are likely to fail because they'll never anticipate all the circumstances in which the rules will be applied. If we're going to increasingly depend on AI-based decision-making, then we're going to have to grapple with this problem. Cold logic might never be enough to ensure that the machine behaves the way we'd like it to.
Empathy isn't obviously something you can reduce to a computer code. At the same time, what I had implied is that whatever morality or lack of it the machine embodies seems likely to impact on us. And this brings me back to my first interviewee in Boston, George Church of Harvard Medical School. I asked him if we should be concerned that the technologies we're developing and perhaps using to alter and augment ourselves are changing us as human beings.
Seems to me so much of the discussion about AI in particular kind of converges on some assumption that if we continue down this path, we'll end up with something that's a bit like us and that will communicate a bit like us. And there's no obvious reason why that should be so, or even if you're talking about brain.
Well, certainly not so far. They're not like us. And in fact, we're not like us. We're becoming increasingly like robots. We treat each other more and more like robots. We increasingly expect people to respond to their text messages as text messages. The nuance of body language and eye contact and all that stuff is lost in the text messages, okay? So I think we're not us, and in fact, we're embracing neuroatypicals more than we ever have before. They're getting more and more rights and privileges. The high-functioning X, high-functioning OCD, autistic, dyslexic, narcoleptic, all these things are being, they're seeing advantages. We're getting better drugs that allow you to be conditionally high-functioning, meaning that you take this drug and you'll be a little bit better in one category. You know, even though you're normally dysfunctional, you can become functional. Or you take this other drug and you'll be microdosing and you'll be different. The point is, humanity is embracing a broader range, and there's a lot more hybrids too. And hybrids create a whole new set of problems. Like, some people have photographic memory; they're allowed into a courtroom, but a camera is not allowed into a courtroom. What's going on there? You know, is that going to, are we going to be able to maintain that duality? Or are we going to start banning people that have photographic memories? What if you need a camera in order to be able to see? You're visually impaired. You have a camera with optical implants. What if that camera records things you have because you have short-term memory problems, et cetera? Are you going to ban those? Where do you draw the line between disabled and someone who just wants to be augmented? We will be hybrids, and it's the hybrids that we should fear more than any particular. So there's some set of people that are obsessed with germline manipulation of intelligence, and another set of people that are obsessed with like people downloading their brains into silicon. And I think really probably neither of those is that amazingly problematic. What's problematic are the hybrids, where we have huge corporations of people with huge machines working in concert, so that neither the people nor machines alone are threatening, but the whole ensemble is. But that's the thing that we're least prepared to do something about. I mean, we can pass laws, you know, banning germline editing, and we can, you know, we can have all kinds of efforts to constrain artificial intelligence, but we have trouble developing the will to constrain companies that do exactly what we want them to do, that they're addictive, they're providing us with what our urges want, but in a way, satisfying our urges is one of the most dangerous things you can do. I start worrying about new technologies the instant I think of it, and I encourage other people as well. I mean, some scientists are perceived as being reassuring. Some of them actually feel that they're being reassuring. I don't feel that that's one of my job descriptions, is I don't need to reassure people. I want them to have a realistic, possibly pessimistic view, so that we don't, so we avoid disasters or even minor inconveniences. If we have a false positive where I worry people about something unnecessarily, that's not so bad. You know, makes for nice movies and books. You know, that are sort of on the dark side or the pessimistic side. In fact, most of science fiction literature has a pretty dark tone to it. So that's harmless to create false positives or false concerns. But false negatives are very dangerous, because it means that when it arrives and you weren't ready for it, then you go in full reactive mode rather than proactive. And full reactive mode, you tend to make more mistakes and you create problems. Your solutions are bigger problems than the problem. So I think it's very important to talk about these things way in advance, which is what I try to do.
George might not consider it his job to reassure us, but I think it is vital that we're thinking about these things now. That, unlike Victor Frankenstein, we are curious about how our creations will behave, even while we're building them. And in particular, how they will interact with us and affect our own behaviour. That's what struck me most in several of these conversations I had in Boston. In thinking about how our artificial being might behave, the question comes back to our own behaviour. Because that, in my view, is what Mary Shelley's book was really all about. What responsibilities we have to our creations, to each other, and to ourselves. How do we make sure that we don't ourselves become the monster? It was a huge pleasure to spend my summer in Boston with the scientists who gave their time for these conversations. For that, I'm deeply grateful to George Church, Robert Langer, Alan Jasanoff, Toma Ullman, David Cox, and Ayad Rawan. If you've not yet had a chance to listen to all 6 episodes, I hope you will. Oh, and finally, about my second brain. As I said at the outset, it is no more. Once it was grown, it was sliced up for inspection under the microscope. But that's not necessarily the end of that little bit of me. I still have some of my stem cells frozen in a lab in London. And who knows what lives they may lead.
How to Grow a Human, My Frankenstein Summer, is written and presented by Dr. Philip Ball and directed and edited by Keith English. This show is brought to you by Aura Studios. Listen to the full series on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.